5. The Hero as Emperor and as Tyrant. The hero of action is the agent of the cycle, continuing into the living moment the impulse that first moved the world. Because our eyes are closed to the paradox of the double focus, we regard the deed as accomplished amid danger and great pain by a vigorous arm, whereas from the other perspective it is, like the archetypal dragon slaying of Tiamat by Marduk, only a bringing to pass of the inevitable. The supreme hero, however, is not the one who merely continues the dynamics of the cosmogonic round, but he who reopens the eye, so that through all the comings and goings, delights and agonies of the world panorama, the one presence will be seen again. This requires a deeper wisdom than the other, and results in a pattern not of action, but of significant representation. The symbol of the first is the virtuous sword, of the second, the scepter of dominion, or the book of the law. The characteristic adventure of the first is the winning of the bride is life. The adventure of the second is the going to the father is the invisible unknown. Adventures of the second type fit directly into the patterns of religious iconography. Even in a simple folktale, a depth is suddenly sounded when the son of the virgin one day asks of his mother, "Who is my father?" The question touches the problem of man and the invisible. The familiar myth motifs of the atonement inevitably follow. The Pueblo hero, water jar boy, asked the question of his mother.
"Who is my father?" he said. "I don't know," she said. He asked her again, "Who is my father?" But she just kept on crying and did not answer. "Where is my father's home?" he asked. She could not tell him. "Tomorrow I am going to find my father." "You cannot find your father," she said. "I never go with any boy, so there is no place where you can look for your father." But the boy said, "I have a father. I know where he is living. I am going to see him." The mother did not want him to go, but he wanted to go. So early next morning she fixed a lunch for him, and he went off to the southeast, where they call the spring Wayu Pawidi, Horse Mesa Point. He was coming close to that spring. He saw somebody walking a little way from the spring. He went up to him. It was a man. He asked the boy, "Where are you going?" "I am going to see my father," he said. "Who is your father?" said the man. "Well, my father is living in this spring." "You will never find your father." "Well, I want to go into the spring. He is living inside it." "Who is your father?" said the man again. "Well, I think you are my father," said the boy. "How do you know I am your father?" said the man. "Well, I know you are my father." Then the man just looked at him to scare him. The boy kept saying, "You are my father." Pretty soon the man said, "Yes, I am your father. I came out of that spring to meet you." And he put his arm around the boy's neck. His father was very glad his boy had come, and he took him down inside the spring.
Where the goal of the hero's effort is the discovery of the unknown father, the basic symbolism remains that of the tests and the self-revealing way. In the above example, the test is reduced to the persistent questions and a frightening look. In the earlier tale of the clam wife, the sons were tried with the bamboo knife. We have seen in our review of the adventure of the hero to what degrees the severity of the father can go. For the congregation of Jonathan Edwards, he became a veritable ogre. The hero blessed by the father returns to represent the father among men. As teacher, Moses, or as emperor, Huang Ti, his word is law. Since he is now centered in the source, he makes visible the repose and harmony of the central place. He is a reflection of the world axis from which the concentric circles spread, the world mountain, the world tree. He is the perfect microcosmic mirror of the macrocosm. To see him is to perceive the meaning of existence. From his presence, boons go out. His word is the wind of life. But a deterioration may take place in the character of the representative of the Father. Such a crisis is described in the Zoroastrian Persian legend of the Emperor of the Golden Age, Jemshid.
All looked upon the throne and heard and saw nothing but Jemshid. He alone was king, absorbing every thought. And in their praise and adoration of that mortal man, forgot the worship of the great Creator. Then, proudly, he to his nobles spoke, intoxicated with their loud applause, "I am unequaled, for to me the earth owes all its science. Never did exist a sovereignty like mine. Beneficent and glorious, driving from the populous land disease and want. Domestic joy and rest proceed from me. All that is good and great waits my behest. The universal voice declares the splendor of my government, beyond whatever human heart conceived, and me, the only monarch of the world." Soon as these words had parted from his lips, words impious and insulting to high heaven, his earthly grandeur faded. Then all tongues grew clamorous and bold. The day of Jemshid passed into gloom, his brightness all obscured. What said the moralist? "When thou wert a king, thy subjects were obedient. But whoever proudly neglects the worship of his God brings desolation on his house and home." And when he marked the insolence of his people, he knew the wrath of heaven had been provoked, and terror overcame him.
Persian mythology is rooted in the common Indo-European system that was carried out of the Aral-Caspian steppes into India and Iran, as well as into Europe. The principal divinities of the earliest sacred writings, Avesta, of the Persians, correspond very closely to those of the earliest Indian texts, the Vedas. But the two branches came under greatly differing influences in their new homes, the Vedic tradition submitting gradually to Dravidian Indian forces, the Persian to Sumero-Babylonian. Early in the first millennium BC, Persian belief was reorganized by the prophet Zarathustra, Zoroaster, according to a strict dualism of good and evil principles, light and dark, angels and devils. This crisis profoundly affected not only the Persian, but also the subject Hebrew beliefs, and thereby, centuries later, Christianity. It represents a radical departure from the more usual mythological interpretation of good and evil as effects proceeding from a unique source of being that transcends and reconciles all polarity. Persia was overrun by the zealots of Muhammad, AD 642. Those not converted were put to the sword. A poor remnant took refuge in India, where they survive to this day as the Parsis, Persians, of Bombay. After a period of some three centuries, however, a Mohammedan-Persian literary restoration took place. The great names are Firdausi, Omar Khayyam, Nizami, Jalal al-Din Rumi, Saadi, Hafiz, and Jami. Firdausi's Shahnameh, Epic of Kings, is a rehearsal in simple and stately narrative verse of the story of ancient Persia down to the Mohammedan conquest.
No longer referring the boons of his reign to their transcendent source, the emperor breaks the stereoptic vision which it is his role to sustain. He is no longer the mediator between the two worlds. Man's perspective flattens to include only the human term of the equation, and the experience of a supernal power immediately fails. The upholding idea of the community is lost. Force is all that binds it. The emperor becomes the tyrant ogre, Herod Nimrod, the usurper, from whom the world is now to be saved.